to me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I'd like to welcome everyone who's interested in positive change. My guest is Greg Palast today, and we're going to talk about Governor Cuomo's sneak attack to bail out the nuclear power industry in New York State. How much? $8 billion. Who's going to pay for it? You and I, with increased utility rates. But I thought nuclear was too cheap to monitor. Yeah, well, that and a lot of other myths about it we're going to explore with Greg. Godfrey Bloom tells the European Union what he thinks of central bankers. What a refreshing insight. And on MSNBC, Lawrence O'Donnell praises Rand Paul for Rand Paul's comments on social injustices. And I think this is important. Also, Monsanto had a hand in Iraq. I'll tell you a story you didn't know. It's more than oil. It's more than gas. It's seeds. And later in the show, we'll end with a, you got Trump trouble, Randy Rainbow song parody. Think you'll enjoy it. Let's begin. A study shows changes in brain activity after mindfulness therapy in young people, and this was University of Cincinnati. Now, mindfulness could be anything that allows a person to calm themselves, relax, meditate on their breathing, concentrate on their breathing, where they just become one with the moment they're in. And they're breathing, they're relaxing, their body relaxes, their shoulders, their muscles, their back. And time just passes so easily. You're not thinking about anything. You're not cluttering or competing with thoughts in your brain. It's another way to help you sleep at night. If you start thinking about your problems, you won't go to sleep. But this is one way to help. This is what they say. Quote, anxiety disorders are among the most common psychiatric conditions affecting children and adolescents. And while antidepressants are frequently used to treat youth with anxiety disorders, sometimes antidepressants may be poorly tolerated in children who are at high risk of developing bipolar disorder. Researchers found that by studying cognitive therapy and mindfulness techniques such as meditation, quiet reflection, and facility-led discussion may serve as an adjunct to pharmaceutical treatments. Half of that they're absolutely right on. The other half they're absolutely wrong on. But let me put this challenge out, not just to the University of Cincinnati, and not just to the journalist, and not just to the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology, who I believe are all well-intended. I do not question their integrity or their motives. But I do question you using science. When science ceases to break down its own myths and barriers and becomes orthodox, it ceases to be science. That said, show me a single study in the entire world literature that can prove that there's a brain chemical imbalance that leads to depression, anxiety, or bipolar. Show me one single study that justifies the legitimate physiological phenomena of bipolar. You talk about it, you diagnose it in babies, they'll laugh and cry. Suddenly they got bipolar and they're given a drug. You have allowed the artificial diagnosing of conditions that do not exist so that drug companies can sell drugs to toddlers, infants, 300,000 last year in the United States, under 2 years of age, were given psychiatric medication that can permanently alter their brain chemistry destructively, destroy synapse, and cause learning disabilities and behavior problems. So why would you say that mindfulness should be used as an adjunct, meaning first you do the pharmaceuticals, but then you do this? I've heard this so many times. Now, here's a test for the audience. The next time you see an ad for diabetes medication, always see with exercise and nutrition, then it will have a benefit. Well, that's not science. What is it? Is it just the drug causes the benefit? Is it meditation cause the benefit? Is exercise cause the benefit? Is it the diet that causes the benefit? Because any condition you can show me, any condition, this is a challenge to medicine. You bring me a patient, any patient, I don't care what stage they're at, that you've had on your drug therapy, and let's see what I can do with no drugs, because I never advocate, offer, recommend any drugs, because I see how dangerous they are, and I count the bodies that are in the morgue. Now, I had one hell of a dinner last night with someone high up in the medical industrial complex. You should have been a fly on the wall, because I challenged this man to show some humility in the face of 10 million dead Americans over the last 20 years from medical conditions or what is called iatrogenesis, including the properly approved drugs that themselves cause the death. I said, when you've had a war on cancer for 45 years and you've had nearly $1 trillion you've been given, you've been given a blank check, you've been given everyone's trust, 99% of all people being treated for cancer use orthodox methods, and you're putting 560,000 in the morgues this year, toe-tagged. They did exactly what they were told. They took all their chemotherapy, all their radiation, and they're dead. Show me your study. Show me one single study for any chemotherapy done with a real placebo, not another pharmaceutical, not another chemotherapy, where you had a statistically significant survival rate after 5 years, where the person had no cancer in the body after 5 years. I can show you those statistics for Dr. Lawrence Burton, Dr. Manuel Vesey, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez. You cannot show me one for yours. You cannot show me a single drug that's cured depression or anxiety disorder, not one. You have no science on your side, none, zip. Psychiatry is a complete, total fraud. The pharmaceutical industry knows that, psychiatrists know that. Unless they're humanistic, holistic psychiatrists, then I support them. They do help people through talk therapy. But oh, I forgot. You weren't the ones who apologized to the parents who found their kids dead from suicide after taking your antidepressant, anti-anxiety medications. Maybe I'm wrong, though. Maybe some psychiatrists or general physicians called and apologized for having contributed to an unnecessary death. No, we didn't miss it. It doesn't happen. That's called hubris and arrogance. I want to tell you the temperature in that room last night, the restaurant, might have been 80, but it's about 5,000 degrees of intensity. And I won't say more about it because it's one of the most powerful and important people in the entire medical industrial complex. And long overdue challenge to them. So the next time you hear that you have a choice, mindful meditation or pharmaceutical approach, just remember there is no science on the side of an unscientific medical industrial complex. They have no science for their statin drugs, for their diabetic medication, for their brain medication, for their pain medication. It is one giant scam. But here's the challenge. Bring me the patient you've never been able to help. How about that? And we'll do it all publicly. And let's see at the end of a year how the patient does using no medicines, no matter what the condition. 1/3 of women with ADHD, well, gee, you got some support for that? University of Toronto? Show me your support. Show me that ADHD is real in adult women. Show me the study that proves that there is a brain chemical imbalance that can be diagnosed with ADHD. Now, I can show you anxiety in women. I can show you stress that manifests as a hyperagitation. That's normal. That's real. And that's been universal, including with Cicero's daughter. So it's nothing new. But the moment you say to a woman you have ADHD or you have acute anxiety disorder, or you have social anxiety disorder, or you have authority defiance disorder, you have dehumanized that woman. You have objectified her as an easily reductionistic mechanic, and you're going to fix her. But you've never fixed one woman with ADHD. because A, it doesn't exist in women. B, there's no chemical brain imbalance in those women. And C, your efforts to try to pretend there are. Oh, but you believe that so many psychiatrists say there's brain chemical imbalance, so you justify giving all these drugs. So by consensus. So consensus is the new science. I see. That's really scientific, isn't it? Oh, did I tell you that we have secretly filmed your national convention? Did I mention that every single one of your world leaders at your convention, when asked to define chemical imbalance, said none exists? Did I miss saying that? You'll see it soon enough. You'll see the truth. In your face truth, you frauds. I consider you the lowest of the low when you exploit women, the elderly, the sick, and children and babies for a profit. Shame on you. But we have the proof, and you'll see it very shortly. You also see going into 12 of the leading, most famous psychiatrist offices in America with a completely normal, healthy young person who is then diagnosed within anywhere from 2.5 minutes to as many as 7 minutes with a brain chemical imbalance that didn't exist and given prescription drugs. And then you'll see what happens when they're confronted on the street afterwards. Show me the science of your diagnosis. Show me the safety of your prescription medication. Show me a study that shows that this prescription medication can actually reverse or improve this person's condition. And then watch them squirm. But don't expect that in the New York Times or ABC or 60 Minutes. No, they take on lightweights. Take on someone who can fight back. Take on the Red Cross. Take on Hillary Clinton. Take on people who have formidable people around them who play dirty. Take those people on. I'd like to see it. Cinnamon. And if I miss defending any psychiatrist, I'm apologizing. I'll get to you on the next round. I don't want to leave any out. In the entire mental health field, I'm including them as well. And probably 95% of all physicians, I'm throwing you in there also. I'm leaving no one out of this. Because who stands up and who speaks power to power on behalf of all the innocent people who trusted you and are dead? And you profited from it. Who's confronted you on it? What lessons have you learned from your failures? None. Because nothing changes in medicine. Won't and can't. There's just too much money of it. Oh, and your great godfather, Lawrence Fishbein, the head of the AMA, one of the most evil human beings in American history. Oh, I just finished a documentary on him, the entire history of the AMA. So AMA went after you once, and you lost, clear up to the Supreme Court. I'm coming after you again. I want people to know what your organization represents, where you get your money, what you do with it, how much power you have, and how you do not use that power to enhance people's well-being. I told you I got a bunch of films coming this fall, and they are not cupcake films. The right kind of cinnamon enhances memory, improves learning ability, and can reverse Parkinson's. This is from Rush University Medical Center. Quote, eating one of the tastiest household spices may also improve learning ability, memory, and even reverse Parkinson's disease, according to a new study published in the Journal of Neuroimmune Pharmacology. Now, how's that possible? Well, cinnamon is one of the most potent antioxidants in the world, and regular consumption can lower blood sugar, help digestion, ease arthritis, and lower blood pressure, and even help with the prevention of Alzheimer's. If you maximize it, then you're getting it in its most pure form. The best cinnamon in the world is the purest form, which is Jamaican cinnamon, or salon cinema. And I would suggest an eighth of a teaspoon with meals. And it can make an enormous difference. Put some in your health shake in the morning, and it can make a big difference. And there are studies that substantiate that. And it can, it's not just tasty, it's medicinal. And there's also just finished a conference on polyphenols. That would mean your teas. And they found that the phenolic phen, P-H-E-N, olic, O-L-I-C, compound, content, made all the difference in the world. So you want to get the teas like green tea, white tea, black tea, and oolong tea. Those are all very rich in these polyphenols, and those can help with your brain, increase microcirculation. Those are rich in flavonoids and phenolic acids and sobeans and lignans. They're all good. So one more reason to have your organic green tea or other teas every day. They can make a difference. Also, finally, high omega-3 fatty acid is associated with lower colorectal cancer death rate. This is Massachusetts General Hospital, published in the peer-reviewed journal Gut. It shows that those people who consume the omega-3 fatty acids, there's your almonds, your flaxseed, hemp powder, avocados, you have less opportunity to have colorectal cancer. Quote, our findings provide the first line of population-based evidence for the benefit of marine omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids on colorectal cancer survival. They looked at 121,000 women who took part in the Nurses' Health Study and 51,000 men in the men's physicians' Health Study, and those who had, over a 10-year period, the most of the omega-3 fatty acids had up to a 41% lesser risk of mortality from colorectal cancer. So, wow, that's important that omega-3 can help prevent colorectal cancer. So, now that's one type of information, the type that what you do, what you put in, can make a difference. Some green teas and omega-3 fatty acids and meditation, all important. But then there's the other side of the equation, that is what you don't do or stop doing. This is one study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that says, quote, University of Texas, early obesity ups your risk of cancer, which means that if you're overweight, which most American kids are because they're not exercising and they're eating junk food, lots of sugar, lots of animal fat, sodas, you're going to be far more at risk in your 20s and 30s of having cancer. Not good. Also, the drugs that you take for the illusionary ADHD, according to this, says that, quote, a 54-year-old mother of two living in McAllen, Texas, was preparing to take her eldest son to school. She had an early appointment, and she'd be dropping her school off. About a month earlier, Matthew, her son, had been diagnosed with ADD and ADHD, as are millions of American kids, and was given medication. He was given Adderall XR pill that morning with a glass of water. But it was her husband who later found him after he had collapsed on the bathroom floor. My husband had seen him walking around, brushing his teeth. Then he walked in and found him flat on the floor in the bathroom. When he turned him over, his lips were blue. And they called 911. They worked on him for a while, but he had died. And she's just one of a handful of parents across the country who believes that their children's sudden death was due to the use of the drugs to control ADHD. And then you start looking at the drugs, and lo and behold, it shows in the medical literature that, quote, reports of cases of sudden unexplained death among children taking stimulants for ADHD have raised concerns over the use of the medications in the past. the Food and Drug Administration Adverse Event Reporting System identified 11 sudden deaths in pediatric patients taking the drugs just in a short period of time. So you may say, well, that's not a whole lot. Well, what is the value of a single life that didn't have to die? Suddenly, if it was your child that was put at risk of dying, you would be concerned. I believe that all children's lives should be valued. And taking these drugs is a travesty. I've written extensively on that. If you'd like to see what you can do to help children who've been diagnosed and given drugs for ADHD, like Ritalin, Adderall, then get them off the drugs. If they're hyper, it may be an effect of their social conditioning, what they're eating. It could be all the different stimulants that they're exposed to, like caffeine and sugar, cell phones and computers and laptops, all of which are adversely affecting the cells and the mitochondria and the DNA. It may be that they might have some previously unrecognized effect from taking vaccines, where they're not overtly having a problem, but subtle problems. You see, we miss subtle subclinical deficiencies all the time. Either way, just remember, ADHD drugs are linked to sudden death. Also, there's colorectal cancer, according to Science Daily, increasing in young adults. And they go through, it's a major increase. Why? The diet, high fat, high fat and high meat, which is what kids are eating now, it increases the risk of colorectal cancer. Quote, this is from the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. A high-fat diet can increase your risk of pancreatic cancer. Once again, a diet. So if you get rid of the high fat, you lessen your chance of colorectal cancer. If you start getting healthy fats, olive oil, coconut oil, flaxseed oil, almond oil, avocado oil, healthy oils, then you reduce your risk. But the bad oils and the bad fats increase your risk. This is from the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. This was a multimodal treatment study reported by David Gutris. Quote, stimulant drugs such as Ritalin for ADHD provide no long-term benefits in the treatment of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, according to the latest findings. According to the previous analysis of MTA data, stimulant drugs do improve the social functioning and reduce symptoms of inactivity or inattention and hyperactivity in children with ADHD for about a year, then they don't work. Well, I would suggest they don't work at all. Here's the problem. When you're giving a child that's hyper or agitated or bored and you give them a drug, the drug changes how the brain responds to the immediate stimuli in their immediate cognitive field. The brain takes a while to rebalance itself, to create a new homeostasis. It has to adapt to this new chemical stimulation. And in that period of time, children seem to mellow out. But that's not true. What is really happening is their body is going through a source of almost trauma. And so you will notice some lessening of symptoms. Does it help them with better grades? No. Does it help them better study? No. Does it help them with greater retention of information that they have studied? No. Do they get better test results? No. Now, that's a review of the actual scientific literature. And I just finished that review last week, and I'm writing an article on it, so it's very familiar to me. So all the reasons we have oversold the diagnosis and oversold the drugs for the diagnosis, we then don't look at the actual situation that it adversely affects their appetite, so they end up with multiple deficiencies, including protein deficiencies. They end up with nutrient deficiencies, and no one's paying attention. They end up with insomnia. They can't sleep, so then they have to take another drug to sleep. Now when they come back out, they can be hyper again, so then they're given something else to bring them down again. Then they can get too far down, then they're given another thing to get them back up again. So a kid can be on four or five different medications, all of which are negatively interacting with one another. Your kid is not a laboratory experiment. Your kid is not chemistry 101. So stop treating the body as if somehow science has found a miracle elixir to allow a child to actually focus. Maybe if you were a better teacher, maybe if your curriculum were more geared to what kids need to know, maybe if you were a good teacher and tried to teach, but maybe the parents weren't good parents. Maybe the kid is not a good kid. Maybe there's some combination. Maybe the world outside is trying to overstimulate the kid, and the world inside in the classroom can't compete with that unless you're a really creative and dynamic teacher. Maybe you're faced with all these obstacles, the diet, the caffeine, the late sleeping, and then waking up unprepared for the immune system to respond to the day and being dragged and haggard through the day. So you take your coffee and you take a jolt drink, and you get 1,000 milligrams of caffeine, enough to kill you. And then you're having sugar loads. Then you have your pizzas, and you have your refined carbohydrates, and you have your hot dogs and hamburgers. You have your French fries. You have junk food. And then when you start feeling low again, you have more caffeine. And now you get your cell phone all the time, and it's blasting electromagnetic pulses into the chromosomes and shortening your telomeres. And it's adversely affecting your DNA and your hormones. And now when you go to sleep at night, you put your cell phone underneath your pillow, and it's pulsing all night long. And 41 separate studies show it can create brain cancers. And before the brain cancer, you have to create inflammation. When you create inflammation, it disrupts normal behavior in the brain and increase what is called mega-channeling. The DNA floats out of the mitochondria, so you kind of walk around brain fatigued. And now you're overstimulated by one environment, and you're understimulated by another. And now you're tired. So when you get to class, for the next 2 hours, you're just tired. So you look out the window. You can't focus. And so now the teacher, by consensus, decides that certain artificially constructed symptoms represent a true biological phenomena. It does not. So no one is taking the time to really sit with you and to try to understand what's going on in Jimmy's life. And unless you have a behavioralist who is humanistic and holistic and compassionate, sit and really find out, you're not going to change anything. So you're going to give them a drug, and then you're going to think the drug works, but it doesn't. Just like all the people every day taking chemotherapy, absolutely believing their oncologist that it works. How much money did your oncologist make off that drug? Oh, you didn't know they can buy the drug at wholesale at $5,000, sell it to you for $12,000, so you just became $7,000 each time you come into the office, $250,000 plus. And with not all the expenses for the average life of a cancer patient, that doesn't include the roses at the funeral, and you don't question that maybe there might be some ulterior motive, greed, selfishness involved in the decisions that are being made on your behalf. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Now we're going to speak with Greg Palast. Greg is a journalist whose news-breaking stories and investigations have appeared on the BBC and The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and now Rolling Stone and others. And the British Tribune K has called Greg the most important investigative journalist of our time. He's broke a lot of stories, including the Florida District theft of votes and the 2000 Bush-Gore election, British Petroleum's corruption over the Deep Horizon catastrophe in the Gulf, Bush's secret pre-invasion plans to capture Iraq's oil fields, the U.S. attempt at coups against Hugo Chavez. He's won a lot of awards, including the George Orwell Award for Courage in Journalism. And he also is New York Times bestseller, Billionaires and Bailout Bandits, and Armed Madhouse, and The Vulture's Picnic. in his new documentary, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Tale of Billionaires and Bailout Bandits, will premiere next Wednesday at the Democratic Alternative Convention in Philadelphia at 8:30 p.m. And his website's gregpalace.com. Nice to have you with us today, Greg.
Glad to be with you, Gary. You hear the sirens, so you know I'm in New York.
Okay. Greg, this week, I saw a documentary down at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and it was called Indian Point. And
yes.
It spent a lot of time inside Indian Point, having unique access to every part of the plant and hearing the stories of the engineers and the people who I genuinely believe were telling us the truth about how safe the plant is. It's as safe as it could be, and why we need nuclear, and why it's so cheap to have nuclear, and without it, we're going to have a lot of problems. And if I were to watch this and not know what I know, I would come away being very pro-nuclear. Now, what's interesting, the people they showed who were challenging nuclear, mainly a couple, he was more of a pro-nuclear person. The wife was made her look like a real angry activist. That's all she does, just protest. And it was interesting because one of the scenes that they were at was the scene where I was in front of Indian Point with a group of scientists from around the world protesting against Indian Point. None of that was shown. Also, they didn't have anyone that I considered a credible scientist actually interviewed, such as yourself or Helen Caldicott, Michio Kaku. They didn't have Harvey Wasserman. There's a whole list of at least 15 outstanding scientists and journalists who could have showed you the truth about Indian Point, because at no point did anyone get up and say, here's all that we know that's wrong with Indian Point. It was all about, well, you know, the water's too hot, 220 degrees, so 1.2 billion fish are killed, so that's the issue. Well, okay, maybe we can get a way to cooling that water down. Well, we have all these spent fuel rods, but they're safe. They're here. Not one discussion about how a nuclear attack could affect it. Not one discussion about how cyber attack could close down the electricity that feeds all that and turn off the turbines, in which case then you have a Fukushima within between 5 to 30 days, depending upon how much backup fuel they have. And they're only required to have a week, but they may have 2 weeks, may have as much as a month, none have more than that in all of America. Not a discussion of this, even though that is actually what is most likely to happen if there's any war between Russia, China, Iran, the United States. Someone is going to play the card of cyber warfare. No mention. Terrorists, no mention. Or the actual problems and historical problems, no mention. I walked out of the theater thinking, wow, boy, and I don't question the integrity of that filmmaker. I'm thinking, this is such a pro film. Now we just find out that Governor Cuomo wants to spend $8 billion of New York residents' money bailing out the nuclear industry for three upstate nuclear plants. The cost will be imposed on every electricity consumer in New York through higher energy bills. And this may be the largest corporate subsidy in New York history, and the public has been given only 2 weeks to comment. And corporate interests are trying to fast-track the decision before the public knows what hit them. And not only will residents have to foot the bill for this bailout, but they also will be denied safer, cleaner, and more affordable energy. And if this proposal, what I consider a scam, goes through, New York will end up spending two times more money on bailing out old, dirty, dangerous reactors than on building safe, clean, affordable, renewable energy. Your thoughts, please.
Okay, a couple things, Gary. I think a lot of people know me, Greg Palast, as a journalist. I'm now with Rolling Stone, before BBC and The Guardian. But before I was a journalist, I had a real job. I was an investigator for the state of New York and the Justice Department. One of my biggest investigations was the nuclear industry in New York. So I was hired by Andrew Cuomo's daddy to investigate the nuclear plants in New York and their builders. And we closed the Shoreham nuclear plant. And what I found out, that the nuclear industry's main ingredients, besides steel and concrete in building a nuclear reactor, the third major ingredient is telling several lies to government about reactor safety and evacuation plans. You know, as you know, with Indian Point, it's within 30 miles of New York. Now, when Fukushima went up, the U.S. government told all U.S. citizens and all U.S. government employees to move 50 miles from the Fukushima plant. In the United States, we have, by law, a limitation of planning for only 10 miles. There is no plan. In fact, it is illegal to plan beyond 10 miles. New York City is 30 miles. So under the U.S. State Department's own rule, anything goes wrong at Indian Point, New York has to be evacuated. New York City has to be evacuated. To where? All of Long Island has to be evacuated. Where are they going? How are they going? And I can tell you, when we investigated the evacuation plan for the Shoreham nuclear plant in Long Island and simply moved the evacuation zone from 10 to 20 miles, you can't evacuate people. You're leaving people to die and be maimed in a cloud of radioactive gunk. If we have a Fukushima in the United States at Indian Point, that's the end of New York City. Forever. Forever. Chernobyl still, even at this point, decades later, within 30 miles of the plant is a dead zone. And if Indian Point goes, just like Chernobyl, we'd have that dead zone. Now we've got something new going on here. Financial meltdown. Financial radiation. Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, under the guise of saying he's really worried about the 600 jobs that would be lost if they closed that hot piece of junk, the Fitzgerald nuclear plant upstate, he's supposedly worried about their jobs. Actually, if you're going to use $8 billion of ratepayer money, how about using that $8 billion to take the 600 workers and put them to work insulating homes in that area, putting up solar and wind sources, basically creating a conservation program which would easily employ those 600 union workers at the plant right now and not without endangering them, their families, or the community. So why is Cuomo doing this this gimmick of using $8 billion of ratepayers' money? Remember, if he had to collect $8 billion in taxes, he'd be thrown out of office, but you sneak it into the electric bills. $8 billion added into the electric bills for a junk piece of plant. And why? Because they're going to subsidize the sale of this plant from Entergy to Exelon. Now, who is Entergy? Entergy used to be called Mid-South Utilities. Who is their lawyer? A woman named Hillary Rodham. I understand she's running for president right now. So this is a former Entergy client. Who are they selling to? Exelon. Exelon is the latest alias of Commonwealth Edison of Chicago. Who is their big consultant contractor? David Axelrod. David Axelrod, otherwise known as the campaign manager for Barack Obama and White House counsel. That's where he made his money. He didn't make his money by charging Obama. He made his money by charging Exelon for his services. And so you've got a political lockup here between David Axelrod, the Clinton family and foundation, and the Cuomo family. And basically we pick up the tab. And we face the dangers as citizens. So we're literally paying $8 billion to endanger our kids. It's only in America. And I'm just sorry that there's this kind of political poisoning besides the radioactive poisoning and this financial poisoning. $8 billion being charged those upstate ratepayers is an absolute devastating blow. Think of it as kind of a negative stimulus plan. Think of it as a kind of cyanide to the economy of upstate. I did an analysis of the economic effects of of higher rates on Long Island. You lose all your industry. There's no plastics industry. So there's almost no industry left on Long Island because of the cost of the Shoreham nuclear plant. It eliminated manufacturing on Long Island almost completely. We lost Grumman aircraft, everything. That's what's going to happen upstate. This is deadly. Deadly financially, deadly in terms of radiation, and deadly politically. All this being done to enrich politically connected operators. It's just sickening. It's just sickening.
In the film, the one really good person who stood out was the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He's a nuclear physicist, and he wanted to see if they could be made safe, and if not, it was his suggestion, start closing them down. Don't allow the license to renew them. And then there was this hearing that showed that his own panel members, other members of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, were attacking him for statements that were never verifiable. In fact, to the contrary, everything that they said under oath turned out not to be true. And yet no time did anyone show the opposite. For example, this one Republican, I see him a lot on television, railing against whatever he's he's very similar to this Anthony Weiner guy. He's that bombastic mm-hmm. personality. And he said something to the effect that you say you didn't do this, but we have all these other people who said that you did them. You know, if I have five people tell me someone did something who are credible, that looks like jail or something to that effect, meaning if enough people say that you, under oath here before Congress, that you did something, you did it. And I, as a director, as a filmmaker, I would have immediately put in there all seven of the CEOs of the seven tobacco industries lying under oath about, oh, there's nothing addictive. We don't know anything addictive to cigarettes. I would have put all the people in the asbestos industry when they first came before Congress who lied, about DDT who lied, about Agent Orange who lied before Congress, about the quality of the American diet and sugars and lying, who represented the sugar industry, and all the other people who have, and Wall Street people who lied. Congress has a history of people coming and lying under oath. So and that's where you could have nailed them, but then they didn't go into these people's backgrounds. Who do these people work for? What boards of directors they associate with? Can you show any link between the people saying the head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission who wants healthy, safe nuclear plants or close them down? Do they have any financial conflicts of interest? Nothing. And this guy was forced to resign. And, yes. And then he became persona non grata. Nobody would hire him. And it shows that he's saying, you know, nobody wants to hear what I have to say now. He's gone. You know, he went to Fukushima just to see how bad it is. And it's still terribly bad there. It's still a major problem. And yet nothing was shown to show the politics of it. So tell us more about the politics. What did you uncover about the company that owns Indian Point? Let us know who they really are, because none of this came out in the film.
Yes, I mean, it is very important to know that Chairman Jaxo, of the Dr. Chairman, was forced to resign. And obviously, he only got forced to resign if the president, Mr. Obama, forces you to resign as chairman of the NRC. He got no backing from the president. And of course, like I say, his main advisor, David Axelrod, is being paid big bucks by the biggest nuclear operator in the country, Exelon, which is the old Commonwealth Edison of Chicago. When Barack Obama began his political career, he began by attacking Commonwealth Edison and saying that they were a scourge, they were poisoning low-income communities on the south side of Chicago. That's when he ran for Congress on the south side, and he lost his race for Congress. And so then a Senate district was created for him along the north shore of Chicago, along the lake shore, and the very rich areas that included the billionaires like Penny Pritzker, who later developed his political career. And so these people are not affected by the poisons created by the operation of Commonwealth Edison, alias Exelon. So pretty soon he went from being the guy trying to dig the dirt on Exelon Corporation to being somewhat of a handmaiden of this, what is the biggest corporation in Chicago, which is its political base. So you've got, and then again, the other utility involved in this was represented by Hillary Clinton under the name Hillary Rodham, with the Rose Law Firm out of Little Rock, Arkansas, which is where they're based. So you have, sadly, you know, and this is the type of stuff that we tend to, you know, see with the Republicans. But now we see the same thing, sadly, happening with Democrats following, you know, the dollar bills on the corporate hooks.
That's the deep evil. Greg, what in closing, what can the people of New York and other places who are listening do to help bring their voice to say, no, we're not bailing out any of the nuclear industries?
Well, I think right now Hillary Clinton is vulnerable from the left. She's trying to keep the left of the party, the young people, the Sanders voters on side. And she switched her position on Indian Point. Again, that was her own client, so she was for keeping Indian Point open. Then when she was running for Senate in New York for re-election, she changed her position to call for closing Indian Point because the pressure was on. So she's vulnerable to pressure, very vulnerable to pressure. And I think that pressure has to be put on Hillary Clinton and her campaign. And Governor Cuomo, who would love to go back into he was housing secretary under Bill Clinton. I think he would love to go back into the cabinet under a President Hillary Clinton. So I think that he has to be on Hillary Clinton and Andrew Cuomo, letters directly to them, not allow this bailout, this abuse reaching into the pockets of New York bill payers.
Good.
Greg, to pay off their political friends.
Thank you very much, Greg. Appreciate you being on today and sharing your concerns about Governor Cuomo's sneak attack to bail out the nuclear power industry in New York State for $8 billion. All the best. Look forward to another conversation. Now, here's what Godfrey Bloom had to say to the European Union, a short clip, on the bankers.
It's my opinion that you do not really understand the concept of banking. All the banks are broke. Bank Santander, Deutsche Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, they're all broke. And why are they broke? It isn't an act of God. It isn't some sort of tsunami. They're broke because we have a system called fractional reserve banking, which means that banks can lend money that they don't actually have. It's a criminal scandal, and it's been going on for too long. To add to that problem, you have moral hazard, a very significant moral hazard from the political sphere. And most of the problem starts in politics and central banks, which are part of the same political system. We have counterfeiting, sometimes called quantitative easing, but counterfeiting by any other name. The artificial printing of money, which if any ordinary person did, they'd go to prison for a very long time. And yet governments and central banks do it all the time. Central banks repress the amount of interest that rates are, so we don't have the real cost of money. And yet we blame the real retail banks for manipulating LIBOR. The sheer effrontery of this is quite astonishing. It's central banks. It's central banks that manipulate interest rates, Commissioner. And plus, underneath all this, we talk loosely, in a rather cavalier fashion, do we not, about deposit guarantees. So when banks go broke through their own incompetence and chicanery, the taxpayer picks up the tab. It's theft from the taxpayer. And until we start sending bankers, and I include central bankers and politicians, to prison for this outrage, it will continue.
Absolutely correct. Thank you, Godfrey Bloom, for having the courage to stand up and tell the truth, something you will not find American bankers or legislators doing. Now, here's what Lawrence McDonald played about Ron Paul on the social injustices black people face.
Politically bravest thing said in Washington today.
If I told you that one out of three African-American males is forbidden by law from voting, you might think I was talking about Jim Crow 50 years ago. Yet today, a third of African-American males are still prevented from voting because of the war on drugs. The war on drugs has disproportionately affected young black males. The ACLU reports that blacks are 4 to 5 times more likely to be convicted for drug possession, although surveys indicate that blacks and whites use drugs at about the same similar rate. The majority of illegal drug users and dealers nationwide are white, but 3/4 of the people in prison for drug offenses are African American or Latino. Why are arrest rates so lopsided? Because it's frankly easier to go into the urban areas and make arrests than it is to go into suburban areas. Arrest statistics matter when applying for federal grants. Doesn't take much imagination to understand that it's easier to round up, arrest, and convict poor kids than it is to convict rich kids. The injustice of mandatory minimum sentences is impossible to ignore when you hear the stories of the victims. Edward Clay, 18 years old, was a first-time offender when he was caught with less than 2 ounces of cocaine. He received 10 years in jail for a mandatory minimum sentence. Weldon Angelos, who the chairman mentioned, was 24 years old and was given 55 years in prison for selling marijuana. There is no justice here. It is wrong and it needs to change.
Absolutely right. If we had conscience, we, the American people, and the 24 million people in America who have been adversely affected by drug arrests of their parents, we would demand clemency for all people convicted of using drugs, expunge their records, and provide proper help in getting them back into the workforce and back into the social fabric, giving them the same benefits, and then end all laws against drugs in the war on crime, war on drugs, which has led to crime. It's as bad as prohibition. And stop criminalizing being poor. Shut down all private jails that put poor people in jail. All right, close them down. We should start a great effort to help those who are suffering. Now, let's hear about the seeds in Iraq that you didn't know about.
Iraq's seed industry, going back to the agricultural aspect. Before 2003, they had a well-functioning, centrally controlled seed industry that had developed over the years a rich seed variety for almost every variation of wheat in the world today. And the farmers in Iraq accomplished this by saving their seeds and sharing them and replanting them. Well, after 2003, that system was destroyed. The research and seed production facilities had significantly deteriorated, also by years of sanctions as well as looting. They had a national seed bank that had seeds dating back thousands of years since the early farmers. It's gone now. And now the supplies of seed demand are supplying only 4%, and that's back in 2005. Now, Paul Bremer came in after the invasion, and you may know Bremer's 100. If you do Pilates, that's a little bit different from the Pilates 100. This is Bremer's 100. That's a joke for those of you who don't do Pilates. His first 100 orders, which were decreed, and no elected Iraqi government that comes after Bremer has the power to alter them, which is apparently the foundation of a democracy in someone's book, not the dictionary. Anyway, Order 81 is important because it affected the agriculture in Iraq, and it's got a legal name, patent industrial design, undisclosed information, integrated circuits, and plant variety law. Well, through all the legalese, basically what Order 81 says is that farmers shall be prohibited from reusing seeds of protected varieties or any variety mentioned in items 1 and 2 of paragraph C, blah, blah, blah. So basically what it says is Iraqi farmers are not allowed to save seeds. They are not allowed to share seeds, no sharing, and they are not allowed to replant harvested seeds. Now, why would Paul Bremer do this? Well, let me tell you a little bit about Monsanto. Monsanto has Terminator seeds, genetically engineered seeds that, as you probably know, produce plants that do not make seeds, which makes farmers dependent on the corporation for seeds every year. Now, Monsanto and Dow Chemical and the Cargill Corporation, they all have an interest here because they're all manufacturing either the seeds or the chemicals to treat those plants with. And they need a place, a laboratory, if you will, to try out their new toys. So, Cargill Corporation, a grain conglomerate, their former vice president, Daniel Amstutz, was made the agricultural advisor to Iraq, also a former USDA official. Now, it was very staggering to me and also very clarifying for me to understand that across the board, from agriculture to mercenaries to oil, this is about corporate profit. And these corporations were like drooling on the possibility of using their Terminator seeds there. Iraq becomes the laboratory for genetically modified wheat. They gave Iraqi farmers 6 types of wheat to grow, only 6. 3 of them are for wheat for pasta. Iraqis don't eat pasta. So a population that is starving to death is given seeds to make half of their production for exports. And who's going to make money off of that? Not Iraqis. They are the guinea pigs in this experiment. And despite the food insecurity that is at heightened, desperate levels today, the food rationing system that started back in 1990 is due to be terminated next month. That's thanks to the influence of the World Bank and the IMF. This means starvation, which pushes people to be more dependent on any crumbs that the corporations hand to them. Sick and wrong.
That gives you another understanding that Iraq was an open door for all multinational corporations to be able to go in and exploit. I'm Gary Knoll. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Dr. Bruce Lipton coming up. We have some outstanding guests tomorrow and the next day. Have a nice day, everyone.
I formally declare Donald J. Trump and Michael R. Pence the Republican nominees for President and Vice President of these United States.
Well, you got trouble, my friends. Right here, I say trouble right here in America. Sure, I'm a liberal and a gay. I'm mighty proud to say. Well, I'm kind of scared to say it. I admit that when Trump threw his name in the race, I assumed he was joking. You know how he jokes about stuff with his cool swag and his orange face. And then he started showing up and winning in the polls, like, a lot. And I was like... But just when I thought it took judgment, brains, and maturity to run for president, I guess that any sh... I'm not saying he's a sh... I'm just saying, never mind. And now that sh... is taking his Chinese suits and his wig and his tiny little hands to the top to debate with a woman who he called corrupt.